Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Public hearings on impeachment started last week, and so we're going to hear a little later from Thomas Mallon about how they compare to the famous hearings on the actions of President Nixon. Mallon is the author of Watergate, a novel. But let's start in the world of entertainment. In 2017, Lena Waithe made TV history. She was the first black woman to win an Emmy for comedy screenwriting. That was for her work on Netflix's Master of None. And the episode she wrote was based on her own experience coming out to her mother. Waithe's debut as a film screenwriter is with the new movie Queen and Slim. And while it's not drawn directly from her own life, the film turns on an experience that's all too common for people of color. A bad run-in with a police officer. Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at The New Yorker, recently sat down to talk with Lena Waithe. And fair warning, they do mention a couple of key plot points in the course of their conversation.
You know, you won the Emmy in 2017, mm-hmm. and, you know, you've been ubiquitous since then. You know, you have the film that's just about to come out, Queen and Slim. You have The Chi. You have 20s. You have the film you were telling me that you just, you know, wrote seemingly like, I mean, it sounds like you wrote it like in the middle of running to pick up your dry cleaning. It was like, oh, let me just, you know, yes, knock out this script here while I'm waiting for them to get my laundry. But in your Showtime series, The Chi, one of your characters, Emmett, who was played by Jacob Lattimore, mm-hmm. is really into sneakers.
Yeah.
And I know you're a major sneakerhead yourself. So do you write a part of yourself into each of your characters?
I can't not, mm-hmm. you know. Yes, I'm the vessel, but because I am, some of me is going to get in there, you know. Mm-hmm. I do try to let the characters speak through me. But it's also therapy for me. It's also a place for me to work out my stuff. My favorite artists are the ones that you can see them in their work.
Mm-hmm.
You see it. You know what that person's trauma is because mm-hmm. it keeps popping up. Especially some of Spike's early work. Like, you see the things he was struggling with.
Mm. It's funny when you said that. I was like, the first person I thought about actually was Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You see his stuff. You know, like Jungle Fever to me is, I think, one of his most underrated movies because it is obviously something that he is grappling with. I don't know if you can make that movie now.
No.
You can't make that movie now.
Some of the themes, I think, that were, like, the conversation was in a particular place when that film first came out.
You can't do that.
Yeah.
Like, people, Black Twitter would, like, lose it.
So I've read that you started watching TV at an early age and that you refer to it as your third parent or your other parent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, just how much TV were you watching and what shows in particular were you really connected to?
Oh, man. I spent a lot of time in front of the television. I think that's not abnormal for kids raised by single parents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I had a very black mom
mm-hmm.
In the sense that there's an old-fashionedness of caring about how our children present,
mm-hmm.
Trying to give us the things, the material things that we need, and also being in a position without our father. So
your father passed away when you were young?
When I was 14,
yeah.
Uh-huh, suddenly. When we lived in my grandmother's house on the south side of Chicago, living in a home and sort of like this almost protected little neighborhood. But I spent a lot of time alone watching television, and I would watch old television because that's what my grandmother wanted to watch. She would watch Good Times and All in the Family, mm-hmm. and I would watch that stuff with her. And then I would watch Cosby Show, Different World, mm-hmm. Living Single, Martin, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and also discovered Mary Tyler Moore Show, Maude, Rhoda.
That's a lot of classic television.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's the thing. I will watch current television, but I was also fascinated by old television. Things like that I would really listen to and learn and pay very close attention to. So in essence, I've been studying this and story and character since I was a very young person and then decided to really learn the craft. And so I went to Columbia College in Chicago, which happened to be my own backyard, and I wasn't quite ready to leave Chicago just yet.
Can I actually, before we leave that though, can mm-hmm. I ask you a little bit about the television part?
Sure.
At what point did you kind of transition from, you know, observing, laughing at it, you know, thinking this is fun, to watching it the way a writer watches those shows, the mechanics of it, the timing and pulling that apart? Like, do you know when you made that transition?
I think high school. Mm-hmm. High school was when I started to discover, like, the commentary, the special features on DVDs. Because I wanted to, I'd watched the episodes a million times, but I wanted to dissect them. I wanted to understand them. I wanted to know why they were written the way they were written.
So let's talk about the soon-to-be-released film Queen and Slim. Mm-hmm. You had pitched this idea at a party by James Fry, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Hollywood Reporter party. I'm at the party, and he introduces himself. Like, he just said, I have this idea for a movie that I can't write. And I was like, all right, what's the idea? And he's just like, yeah, black man, black woman on a first date. It's not going great. It's not horrible. But anyway, they get on there. He's driving her home, and on the way home, they get pulled over by a police officer. Things escalate pretty quickly, and they kill him in self-defense and decide to get in the car and go. Mm-hmm. I thought, that's interesting. And it just, like, stuck with me, and he probably thought he was never going to hear from me again, but I was like, no, let's exchange information. He had a title. He had an outline. I was just like, I don't need any of that. I was like, I just want to take this idea and, like, run with it. My writing resume wasn't as long as it is now, so I don't even know if he knew. It could have been a complete disaster. It could have been, like, not what he wanted, the whole development thing. But the way I get down is that I'm a one-man band when I'm writing, but then I have a whole community of people and artists that I show it to and get feedback from, and a lot of the writers on The Shy season one. Like, I'm really grateful to Kathy Kasakye, who, because initially it was going to start with Queen watching her client be executed. That was initially going to be the first image. She was going to be apologizing to the family for not being able to do enough, not being able to save their son. And Kathy was like, you don't think you need that, just start on the date. And I was like, but then, like, people won't understand, like, why she's so, like, in such a state. And Kathy was like, so what? Like, that's, I remember, like, hearing myself explain, like, why that would be difficult. And then I was like, for all those reasons, like, yeah, that's exactly why I should start this way and let the audience sort of, like I'm going to just peel her like an onion.
The film does, in fact, open on this date. You know, they're a diner. You see these two dark-complexioned African-American people with this light just almost dancing on their skin.
Oh, yeah, it's so, like, beautiful.
Normally, I would go home and have a glass of wine by myself, but I didn't feel like being alone. Not tonight.
You didn't have any friends or family you can call?
No.
So you turned to Tinder?
Yeah.
What made you pick me?
I liked your picture.
What?
You had this sad look on your face. I felt sorry for you.
But what exactly do you want us to know about these two people in that scene?
You know, I think what's presented, you know, what do you know about a person when you sit down on the first date with them? What they choose to present, you know, what you choose to assume, you know, and all the assumptions you make and the assumptions about each other. And they're also an algorithm of all of us in a way. You know, one is religious, one is not. One is close to their family, one isn't. One wants to leave a mark on the world, one wants to just exist in it. They're all of us.
The character Queen, who's played by Jodie Turner-Smith, who's a comparative newcomer, and she's paired with Daniel Kaluuya, who is, like, nuts, involved in everything at this this point. And it's interesting, though, that they don't use their names. Is that kind of
Well, I chose
deliberate?
Not to. That was the thing. I deliberately chose to do that because, and I remember thinking when I was writing it, I was like, can I, like, get away with this? Oh, I'm going to try. Let's see what happens. But I didn't want to reveal their names until they were killed because I don't know Trayvon Martin's name. I don't know Emmett Till's name. I don't know Eric Garner's name. I don't know Mike Brown's name. I don't know Sandra Bland's name unless they were killed. That's how I came to know their names. So that was a thing that I purposefully wanted to do, was to say you often don't know black people's names unless police kill us.
Wow. There's an easy impulse to compare the film to Bonnie and Clyde, which seems off to me. But in a recent interview, you said that it's more like a heterosexual Thelma and Louise. How does the story change when there are two black people on the run in America?
It changes in every way. Because it instantly becomes political. It instantly becomes important. It instantly becomes revolutionary because of literally the color of their skin. And I think what's so palpable about it is who they kill. And it's about what
that they kill the police officer.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And what do the police represent to us?
Mm-hmm.
They represent Jim Crow. They represent, you know, just injustice.
Mm-hmm.
They represent death
mm-hmm.
to us, a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to kill that in a complicated way, it's not intentional. They didn't go out to say, oh, we're going to go kill a cop tonight. You know, they were just existing in the world and trying to find joy. And while doing that, they get pulled over and that joy is interrupted. And writing those two scenes was probably the most difficult thing I've ever done. And I've rewrote those scenes like so many times. And there's so many different variations of those scenes. There was a point where she killed the cop and mm-hmm. he killed it and they both did and strangled. I mean, it was a million different versions of it. And then mm-hmm. I finally landed on what people see. So it really kind of plays with these different things where no one is innocent. No one is guilty. Mm-hmm. Everyone is just trying to survive. I think that's what sparked something in me about the idea. We flip the narrative. We flip it. And then it's then to me it becomes then it becomes a love story. Then mm-hmm. it's about these two people being forced mm-hmm. to get to know each other. They have no choice. But it's also about I used, you know, Malcolm X as sort of a reference point for her and Martin Luther King as a reference point for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end of the film, I think they sort of swap places.
Mm-hmm. So I wondered about this because, you know, the story parallels obviously a lot of what we've seen in the news recently.
Mm-hmm.
The night that I saw the film was the same day that the verdict had come down in the Botham Jean shooting.
Oh. You know,
this is when police officer Geiger shot this young man in his own home.
Yeah, she was sentenced, but it was very light.
Yeah. And then not long after that, we saw the death of 28-year-old Atatiana Jefferson,
mm-hmm.
who's an African-American woman who was killed in her home by a white police officer,
correct.
Also in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever a fear that this subject matter in the film would strike too close to home for viewers?
No. I had no idea this many more black bodies would have dropped by the time we got close to opening. I do not want that kind of publicity
mm-hmm.
for the film.
Mm-hmm.
I do not. Because I am like every other black person. I am traumatized mm-hmm. every time these stories come out. Every time these stories hit our phones, our Instagram feed, our Twitter, our TV, a piece of us dies
mm-hmm.
because we know that we could be next.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really where this story was born out of, you know, me feeling like a second-class citizen, even though people may feel as if I sit in a place of privilege. I don't think people understand, like, the way things were different just a few years ago and where I didn't feel like I had a voice. I didn't feel like I had a person to turn to help me in my space as a early new show creator trying to have a say or agency. And so that's where I went and said, I'm going to write something just on my own. That's the thing no one can take from me. I just wanted to write something about us. But unfortunately, if I'm writing about us, how can I ignore the fact that we're being hunted?
When you say us, you mean African Americans.
We say black people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep spoiling for the film for those who haven't seen it,
mm-hmm.
but I have to ask you about one scene where the man, or Slim, convinces the woman, Queen, to stop at a bar for a quick dance.
Mm-hmm.
They're clearly in a lot of trouble at this point, And, you know, one of the most striking things about the scene is that despite all this trouble that's hanging over them, Slim doesn't really care. You know, he wants to take her out on essentially a date while they are fugitives. And there's a moment in there where he orders a drink, and the bartender is an older Black woman, and she says,
"He's on the house."
"Thank you."
"Don't worry, you're safe here."
And there's a kind of recurring theme, you know, of betrayal and trust throughout. And can you talk a little bit about that scene and what you were thinking about as you created it?
Oh, yeah. I wanted there to be a sense of community, you know, in the film. A sense of unity, a sense of they are heroes in some people's eyes. I had to ask myself, how would those two people be received if they walked into a predominantly Black establishment after being seen on tape killing a cop? How would they be received? Mm. We create the heroes in which we need. And people needed them. They needed them to mean something more than what they were. And but there's also that sort of bit of an Underground Railroad feel of, you know, you can, this is a safe spot. You know, this is a safe haven. You can come hang here for a little bit. But also, because I'm not a simple writer, I know that there's also people maybe of a certain generation that wouldn't necessarily celebrate that.
Sure. There's other African-Americans who are very critical of them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so I made sure that all those voices were heard in a way that felt honest and grounded and true.
You know, one of the first things that struck me was the way in which the incident with the police officer is almost like, the officer is almost like patient zero in an outbreak, where his actions cause every single other person we meet throughout the course of that film to really confront the question of what they stand for. And because the incident is on video, everyone sees it, and they're interpreting it through their own lens.
Absolutely.
And I wonder if that was what you were wanting to do, to kind of put all these people in front of these screens on their phone or on their computers or whatever, and then say, here's this thing. You know, tell me how you interpret this. Tell me what this is.
Right. Well, I think that's what we do every day. You know, when we look at our screen, you know, or see the latest viral video or watch the news, how we take in the news is we interpret it in our own, but we bring our stuff to it. And that's why everybody has different opinions about things. But ultimately, I believe every little choice and thing we do affects our lives. And, you know, that date is a choice. It's a choice that she makes. She doesn't want to be alone that night. I totally hear what you're saying in terms of, I really like that that idea, is that he's the patient zero. But it's also, you know, it's three people grappling with America's history, really, in a moment.
So one last thing.
Yeah.
You've talked about your relationship with television from your childhood, and the way that that evolved, you know, from you observing these shows and enjoying these shows to you studying them and dissecting them and taking them apart. And you had this dream of participating in this world in some way. Is it everything that you would have hoped it to be?
It's more. It's more and it's less. That's the thing.
In what ways?
It's more in that... it's almost like trying to describe to someone what having a child is like. You can talk all day, but until you have your own, you won't know how great it is, but also how devastating it can be. I heard this great thing from a writer in this like program I was doing where you kind of learn how to be a showrunner. And they said, getting your own TV show is like being beaten to death with your own dream. And it's true. That's what it is. You can't want to be the heavyweight champion of the world and not take some licks. So I'm going to get hit sometimes. It's just a matter of if I hit back, which I will.
That's a great way to conclude.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
the writer, actor, and producer, Lena Waithe. She talked with Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at The New Yorker. Waithe wrote the film Queen and Slim, directed by Melina Matsoukas, and it comes out later this month. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, opened impeachment proceedings last week, he very deliberately invoked the specter of Watergate.
These actions will force Congress to consider, as it did with President Nixon, whether Trump's obstruction of the constitutional duties of Congress constitute additional grounds for impeachment.
Now, you can see why Schiff would want to remind us of those Nixon years. Nixon had won his second term in a landslide, but over the course of many hearings and much information that was coming to light, a very different narrative took hold. Nixon came to be seen as a crook, a man who had put his own interests ahead of the country's. And finally, he lost the support of senators, even in his own party. To understand how that precedent applies or doesn't apply to the Trump hearings, we called on Thomas Mallon. Tom's books include Watergate, a novel, and historical fiction about Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. Tom Mallon spoke with The New Yorker's Dorothy Wickenden.
So I thought you could help us see this drama through your eyes, which is there are those of a novelist. So Watergate, in so many ways, really was tailor-made for a novelist. What in specific appealed to you as you began that work?
I used to call Watergate a claustrophobic epic, because you had all of this frantic action in Washington, but it was all happening within the space of a few square miles. It played out over more than 2 years. And you had a cast of incredibly colorful characters, complicated characters. Everybody from these figures of unexpected nobility, like Sam Ervin at the Watergate hearings, the extraordinary tortured psyche of Nixon, really a tragic figure in my estimation, somebody with great political gifts, great really governing gifts, who's done in by this terrible sense of defeat and unfairness that he carried around. The comic characters from Martha Mitchell to Tony Ulasewicz, who was the bagman for some of the money, who tells Richard Nixon's white shoe lawyer, Herbert Kalmbach, at one point, something's not kosher here, Mr. Kalmbach. And all of these quotes, all of these phrases that entered the language.
Remind us of some of those phrases.
Ehrlichman talking about, we'll let this person twist slowly, slowly in the wind. Stonewall really enters the political lexicon at that point. I'm not a crook, Nixon. And my particular favorite, which is the limited modified hangout, which is at what that was a John Ehrlichman phrase. And this was about how we could, you know, be halfway honest about the cover-up. We could admit some things, but hold back others. But a great deal of the memorableness of Watergate, the reason it's so memorable, is the way I think the story unfolded and how the public received it. And I think that in many respects, just as the characters are extremely different from the ones involved in the Trump drama, the conveyance of the story was very different.
You grew up in a rock-ribbed Republican family, and you watched the Watergate scandal as a college student. Do you remember your immediate reaction in June 1972 when you learned about the break-in at the Watergate Hotel?
I don't. And I think in a way that's telling, because I think very few people would remember it. For months, it was referred to in the news as the Watergate caper. That was the way it was. It was kind of this very entertaining little offshoot of the 72 campaign. And Watergate doesn't really explode until early 1973, by which time Nixon has had an enormous victory over George McGovern, carrying 49 states. This candidate who had never felt terribly loved or popular, he had been the vice president for an extremely popular president, Dwight Eisenhower. If you listen to tapes of Nixon receiving congratulations from people on the phone on election night, 1972, one of the things that most fascinated me from the point of view of a novelist was you can hear that he's depressed, and he's depressed by victory. He did not know how to cope with victory. He had grown so used to combat that he really couldn't deal with the fact that this was it.
He kept up his high approval ratings until early 73. Then they started to fall. What caused that?
Well, I think the Watergate revelations came very gradually, and people began to know that something was really wrong. And the other thing is that the scandal spread. Things kept turning up. The Watergate investigations turned up the things that the White House plumbers had done as far back as 1971, what John Mitchell, the attorney general himself, privately referred to as the White House horrors. And it kept unfolding, and people knew there was going to be more and more. And there was this tremendous buildup waiting for the testimony of John Dean.
Now, I guess you're fully aware, Mr. Dean, of the gravity of the charges you have made under oath against the highest official of our land, the President of the United States.
Yes, I am.
And being so aware, do you still stand on your statement?
Yes, I do.
Mr. Chairman, I have no further questions.
I might add this, Mr. Dash. I realize it's almost an impossible task if it's one man against the other that I'm up against, and it's not a very pleasant situation, but I can only speak what I know to be the facts, and that's what I'm providing this committee.
And those hearings were watched by 85% of American households. What is, so we know about Dean, and there was this great character in Senator Sam Ervin, who was the chair of the Watergate Committee.
Yes, I mean, he quoted the Bible, he quoted Shakespeare. His eyebrows went up and down. He had these enormous bushy eyebrows, and they were almost like a second set of hands. And he would get very excited. He was extremely astute about what was going on, and he was a very good judge of character. And he had these snappish exchanges sometimes.
The foreign intelligence activities had nothing to do with the opinion of Ellsberg's psychiatrist about his intellectual or emotional or psychological state.
How do you know that, Mr. Chairman?
Because I can understand the English language. It's my mother tongue.
There really was a kind of cinematic quality to the Ervin hearings. But one of the things that was essential about Ervin, aside from the fact that he was this fantastic sort of personality, just as Trump would say, right out of central casting, of, you know, for an interesting Southern senator, he did not come from the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. He came from the conservative Southern segregationist wing. And it was enormously effective to have somebody who was not one of Nixon's typical tormentors. It gave the hearings a certain kind of credibility, whereas I think a lot of the public, when they look at Adam Schiff, they just see a kind of, you know, Nancy Pelosi-style California liberal. And, well, you know, these people are always out to get Trump. They were out to get him from day one. And, of course, you have to remember that the Irvin hearings were a full year before the Judiciary Committee hearings. Impeachment was really not in the air until later.
And so this is something else Schiff has going against him. He has an incredibly compressed time frame here, given the coming elections in the fall of 2020, and they have to kind of race through this as quickly as possible.
Yes. The timeline was really quite elongated, and that in itself, I think, allowed things to sink in with the public and to build up. My friend and mentor, Mary McCarthy, wrote a little book about the Watergate hearings called The Mask of State. And Mary wrote, "The high points of Watergate were the hearings of the Watergate Committee, summer 1973, and the hearings of the House Judiciary Committee, summer 1974. They made up a gripping serial story that by some freakish chance was seasonal and like a nature myth turned on the phenomenon of rebirth, on the flowering of national institutions that seemed to have died down, but now were coming back every summer, not only in the Capitol, but on TV as a delighted public tuned in. The characters in that drama, in installments, were mostly unfamiliar except for the villain, whom we had been watching on the box for 20 years. But we came to know them like members of the family or old soap opera pals."
These days, the days of Twitter and Fox News and everything else, is it possible that we could even, if we had all of the great characters, that the public would tune in to these hearings the way they did then?
My answer would be no, because what you're really lacking above all in this, aside from all the colorful players, the bit players, the heavies, what you're lacking is a protagonist. Nixon was endlessly fascinating, tragic, gifted, conflicted, mean-spirited, generous. There was something to grab hold of there. I can't imagine writing a novel with Trump as a point of view character, just to be rattling around in that great, weightless, gaseous psyche of his. It just doesn't hold a reader. And as a result, I think it's unlikely in a way to hold the public. The public will say, we never had any illusions about Trump. We always knew he was a bad guy. We always knew he was thuggish. That's why we voted for him. We liked him. That's what his base would say.
So you always look for point of view characters. And if you were writing the story of the Trump impeachment, who would that be?
Oh, I think I would go right to the people who have not kept us from getting to where we are right now. I would go right inside the heads of Lindsey Graham and Ben Sasse and Mitt Romney, the Republicans who know better. Because they cannot be feeling good about themselves. And
yeah, you can see the torment Lindsey Graham written all over his face.
No, and that's absolute catnip to a novelist. A guilty conscience is one of the absolute best springboards for fiction that exist. Watergate almost has a kind of rhetorical subtlety to it and dramatic subtlety to it that this doesn't have. This is just a comic book in some ways.
So do you think Democrats made the right decision or the wrong decision to focus solely on Ukraine? I mean, there's so much information in the Mueller report that is sort of trying to guide them toward possible obstruction of justice on any number of fronts.
It's a hard call. With Nixon, as I said, there was a lot of stuff. It was a variety of stuff. But they did try to load up the impeachment articles with things like the bombing of Cambodia. And that kind of thing left Republicans cold. So I think there's a good case to be made for narrowing things to the most egregious and the most understandable. But I don't think it's going to be enough. And I do think after that, consider how this is going to play out. I mean, my friend Brenda Wineapple's recent book about the Johnson impeachment.
That's Andrew Johnson.
Yeah, back in the 1860s, talks about how when Johnson was acquitted by the Senate by one vote, by a single vote, he basically spun it as a great vindication. And to some extent, history bought into that. Imagine, given everything we know about Trump as showman, bloviator, liar, imagine if he's acquitted in the Senate, how he is going to present that, how he's going to talk about it. You know, you can just hear him now. It's the greatest political victory ever seen in the United States. You know, it's not going to be a matter of escaping justice. It's going to be this kind of gladiatorial triumph.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
You can find Thomas Mounds writing for us at newyorker.com. He's the author of many books, most recently, Landfall. Dorothy Wickenden is executive editor at the magazine, and she hosts our podcast, Politics and More, every week. Stick around because Philip Pullman, the author of His Dark Materials, joins us in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For 8 years, Game of Thrones was a critical darling and a huge ratings bonanza for HBO. And by the time it ended, in May, it was the most talked about show on television, or it certainly seemed that way. Not even 6 months later, HBO has just launched a new show based on a series of beloved fantasy novels. But this one, it's got a lot less nudity and not quite as much beheading. The show is called His Dark Materials, and it's based on a trilogy of books, young adult novels, by the writer Philip Pullman.
What in the world?
This is Lyra and Pantalaimon.
Azrael.
I hereby invoke the privilege of Scholastic Sanctuary.
And among the many fans of those books is The New Yorker's Katie Waldman.
His Dark Materials was first published in the mid-90s, and that leads to an easy comparison with J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books. But Philip Pullman's concerns are very different from hers. His Dark Materials is set in a world parallel to ours and actually occasionally blends into our own world. It stars a sprightly, spunky heroine named Lyra. She has mysterious and unknowable parents. The universe is sort of a patchwork of different fantastical locations and settings. There's kind of a northern sublime world that is populated by armored bears. There are witches. There's a steampunk team of scientists. It's really wonderful. So while HBO is releasing this series based on His Dark Materials, Philip Pullman has just put out a new book set in Lyra's world, and that's called The Secret Commonwealth. So this is the second book of his second trilogy. So if you're counting, that's 5 books set in this universe as of now.
Katie Waldman spoke recently with Philip Pullman, who is at home in Oxford.
So to start off, the HBO-BBC adaptation of His Dark Materials just started airing. You're an executive producer on that show. And back in 2007, there was a film adaptation of the same book, of The Golden Compass, the first book of His Dark Materials. I wonder whether you think that there are any aspects of your work that TV as a medium is particularly well-suited to capture.
Well, I think the human drama
is going to come out well, partly because of the quality of the actors who are going to have to present it. TV works a little better in close-up, I think, than the big movie screen does. So it'll be the human drama that that works very well. I'm happy that the story will be told fully in this form, whereas it couldn't have been told fully on the stage or on the movie screen.
Yeah. There actually will be listeners, though, who are not familiar with the universe of The Dark Materials. And so just to back up a little bit, it's set in a parallel universe to ours. And the biggest difference is that everyone's soul is manifested in an animal that they can talk with and that everyone else can see. And those animals are called demons, right? Is that the correct pronunciation?
That's right, yeah. Yes, in Lyra's world, Lyra is the main protagonist. She's a girl of about 11 or 12. In Lyra's world, everybody has a demon, which is their own part of an aspect of their own self, which is in the form of an animal, and it's outside them, so that their demon can talk to them, can look around corners when they wait in the shadows, that sort of thing. And the relationship between the human and the demon is a very, very close one, and it can't be broken unless by exceptional force or cruelty or something like that. Is the whole story, the arc of the whole story, is really, I suppose, in one simple sentence about the change from innocence to experience, or the change from childhood to growing up. And the demon symbolizes this because children's demons can change shape all the time. According to what they're feeling or what their mood is or how excited they are or whatever. Whereas in adolescence, the power to change gradually fades away and they find one fixed form which they have for the rest of their human companion's life. It was a very good idea, probably the best idea I've ever had.
Yeah. A person's demon is their opposite gender, right?
Well, most of them are. There seem to be a few exceptions, but there are all sorts of things I haven't yet discovered about demons. I often get asked, for example, how demons are born. And my answer is, well, I haven't had to describe a scene in which that happens, so I haven't had to think about it yet. Demon gynecology is a mystery to me.
Can you imagine a world of sort of gender fluidity where demons change according to their partner's gender?
Yeah, I can imagine it, but I haven't had to yet. maybe that'll happen in the third book. Maybe you give me an idea on which the whole story will turn.
So Lyra is what in the States we would call a middle school age student. And I think you taught that age group before you became a professional novelist, right?
Yeah, it was. I taught for about 12 years, and it was children of that age, children between 9 and 13. I taught the sort of 11, 12, 13-year-olds. It's a very interesting age because they are just on the cusp of becoming, entering their adolescence. And all sorts of things are opening out for them. And it's wonderful to see that happening to young children. My own grandchildren are going through that stage at the moment. And again, it's very exciting to see.
Your father was a pilot, correct? And he...
That's right, yeah.
You grew up thinking that he had died in battle?
Yeah. When I was about 7 years old in 1953 or 4, the British were fighting an insurgency, as they called it, in Kenya, the Mau Mau insurgency. And the roots of that lay deep in colonialist history, and it's a thing on which we certainly now in Britain cannot look back with pride. But my father was a pilot, and he was involved in that whole distasteful business, and his plane crashed and he died. I was very young, as at the time I said, I was 6 or 7, and I was either led to believe or came to believe or misunderstood, but I thought he'd been shot down in battle, you see. And so to me, he was a great hero. And it wasn't until much, much later that I realized what he'd really been doing, which was effectively dropping bombs on people who had spears. Well, that complicated the whole thing. And then I discovered other things about his life and about his relations with my mother, which I didn't know about, And it caused me to revise my ideas about a lot of things.
Yeah. Would you characterize that as an innocence lost?
Innocence, oh, I suppose it was in a sense, because, yeah, my eyes were opened. Yes.
I mean, the reason I ask, it just seems that Lyra has a similar experience in the books where she starts out entranced by her father and also her mother, even though they've kept their distance from her. And then over the course of the story, she discovers that there are aspects of them that are less savory and she decides to strike her own path.
That's right, yeah. This is a classic trope, if that's the word I want, in literature that children read, because the first thing you have to do if you're writing a story is to get the parents out of the way. There can be no adventure in a story if the parents are saying, "No, come on, dear, it's bedtime." So you have to get rid of the parents pretty quickly. And that's what happens in this one, of course, as in Treasure Island, as in all sorts of classic children's books.
Yeah. I'd love to actually turn to The Secret Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what drove you to continue the story? I mean, you actually placed the first volume of The Book of Dust in the past, before the events of His Dark Materials, but the second one is after. What drew you back to the world?
Well, I hadn't said enough, at least I hadn't discovered enough in His Dark Materials about dust. Dust with a capital D, this mysterious substance, essence, whatever it is, that seems to pervade the universe, and which in the story, in our universe, is called dark matter. Dark matter is a phrase that fits very well with the line I took from Paradise Lost that gave me His Dark Materials. Dark matter is this invisible, intangible something that holds the universe from together, stops it from flying apart. Its mass is such that gravity doesn't let us escape from it. But we don't know what it is. When I was writing His Dark Materials, 25 years ago or more, scientists hadn't yet discovered what dark matter was, and I kept my fingers crossed that they wouldn't before I finished the book. Fortunately, they still haven't. So the universe is still a very mysterious place.
Yeah, and there's also a kind of maturation of the themes of the earlier trilogy. So Lyra and her demon Pan actually part ways, and Pan appears to be searching for Lyra's lost imagination.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. She's 20. She's an undergraduate. She's a reader, and she's read some books which have influenced her a great deal, but books by two prominent intellectuals of her time and her world. One of them is a fierce rationalist who denies the existence of anything remotely irrational. And the other is a kind of postmodernist who believes that there's nothing, no such thing as truth anyway, and it's all whatever we care to believe. And these people have seriously undermined her security, her intellectual security. And Pan thinks it's because they've stolen her imagination, and he goes off to look for it.
I have so many questions about this. The first is the idea that the demons are merely psychological projections of what is happening internally.
This is what one of the philosophers says.
It does bear a certain resemblance to cultural analysis that has been generated around your own work. And I wonder if this is you trying to engage those arguments within the world of the book itself.
I suppose it is, yeah. I suppose it is. These two different philosophers or intellectuals, they represent strands of thought that are current in the world at the moment, with which I profoundly disagree. The first one, the guy, a German called Gottfried Brander, is this fierce rationalist who believes that the only kind of evidence that's worth having is scientific evidence. Nothing else is of any use at all, and he regards the imagination, the world of art, poetry, etc., with a fierce contempt. I presented this as being a very persuasive argument, which has influenced a lot of young people in Lara's world, including her.
Yeah, in the first trilogy, you describe Lyra as a wonderful liar with a poor imagination. Do you see a sort of tension there?
Yeah. Now, I didn't know why I said that at the time. I'm beginning to see it now. Her imagination is all in Pan, of course. is all in her demon. And it's this lack of connection which sets the story going, I think, in the Secret Commonwealth.
I mean, it's lovely that the conceit of the demon allows you to posit sort of a vision of selfhood as a dialogue between different parts of the self, you know, that there's always multiplicity.
Yeah, that too. I mean, to be more accurate, I suppose I should have about 10,000 demons for each human being, because we don't consist of just two parts, but two is quite enough to manage in the story.
Yeah. I'd love to go back for a second to Lyra and Pan's, so to speak, conscious uncoupling.
Lyra as Gwyneth Paltrow and Pan as whatever her husband's name was.
Oh, goodness.
That's very funny. Conscious uncoupling. Oh, yeah.
Were you consciously sort of framing a metaphor for our adult struggles to use our imaginations?
But mainly I was concerned to see what had caused it and what was going to happen as a result and how they were going to find each other again. Mm-hmm. You don't realize all the metaphorical or implications of what you're writing or telling when you're telling a story. It's sometimes best if you don't spell them out and for readers to pick them up for themselves. And sometimes they have a better explanation than you do. And of course, if they come up with an explanation that is creditable, I'm happy to claim responsibility for it. But we don't always know what we're doing when we're telling a story.
The novelist Philip Pullman. He spoke with The New Yorker's Katie Waldman. The adaptation of His Dark Materials has just come out on HBO, and Pullman's new book is called The Secret Commonwealth. That's The New Yorker Radio Hour for this week, and I hope you'll join us next time. We've got an extraordinary story. It's about a young woman who went into the darkest reaches of the white supremacist movement and came back out again. That story from The New Yorker's Andrew Morantz. See you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.